GeekSpeak on KUSP is supported by Mira Software Services, 1,500 software professionals specializing in the areas of software-defined networking, evolved packet core, and more. Details at mera.biz or 650-479-5350.
It is Saturday, April 26th, 2014. We are broadcasting live from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. This is KUSP Public Radio, 88.9 and KUSP.org. And ladies and gentlemen, it's time now for Geek Speak.
We're through being cool. We're through being cool. Eliminate the ninnies and the twits.
I'm Bonnie Jean Primsch in a host chair today. There's a few people with me also in the studio, including Lyle Troxell, a photographer, programmer, and family dude. Hey, Lyle.
Howdy.
And Ben Jaffe, a web development instructor, musician, and world traveler.
Hello there.
Also, Miles Elam, software engineer and political junkie.
Good morning.
Guten Morgen. Well, a while ago, the geeks talked about what info you can glean from how a battery bounces. And that piqued the interest of chemistry teacher Matt Prater. And later in the program, Lyle Troxell will talk to him and two of his high school students about what they discovered about batteries. But first, Ben, shall we talk about SpaceX?
Yeah, I just want to give a quick shout-out. Congratulations to SpaceX. They successfully not only launched a rocket into space, which was covered last week by us, mm-hmm. but also they successfully docked with the International Space Station, and they dropped off a whole bunch of cool stuff, like science experiments, supplies, and humanoid robot legs.
Oh.
How creepy
what?
Is that?
What? Why did they just bring some humanoid robot legs up there?
Okay, well,
here's... You guys need some legs?
the context is they actually have an experimental humanoid robot aboard the International Space Station, uh-huh. and eventually they are hoping to use it in a spacewalk.
I hope it goes better than the one in that Mars movie. Red Mars or Red Planet.
I think I may have seen that.
Mars Attacks? What?
One where it's, you think, oh, it's Earth's last hope, and like going to Mars and trying to figure out what's going on. So let's bring a robot that has a ability to kill people.
That's a good idea.
Well, are these like supplement to your legs so that spacewalking is easier, or is like straight up?
These
for
are
robots?
Legs for the robot. But before they named it Legolas, but they have to change the name.
What are they going to do now?
I don't know.
Legolas.
That's my
legs.
Dumb joke. That's not actually the truth.
Okay, all right.
And funding that goes along with SpaceX is the fact that SpaceX, the company headed by Elon Musk.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
File suit against the U.S. Air Force.
Why?
Because the U.S. Air Force is limiting where they can launch and where they can land. And the idea is because they're controlling that airspace, and rocket launches are very strongly controlled for security reasons.
I have to say, that kind of makes sense to me, because if the Air Force, like if rocket goes up and people don't know about it or whatever, and then foreign nervous country says, wait a minute, what's going on with that rocket? And Air Force says, huh, what? We don't even know about it.
Well, that's the thing, though, is this isn't a question of they got permission, then go. They're not even being able to get permission. You have these commercial companies like SpaceX asking for permission, saying, hey, we would like to be able to do this. And they're getting a blanket denial, saying you are not allowed to.
You can't build your own private spaceport.
Right. And so they've had to go to the Russians for this.
Oh.
And it's especially funny. Elon Musk has been bringing this up. Especially funny that we've been going to Russia even while we're having these conflict over Crimea with Russia.
We're still partnering up with them on the space stuff.
So basically,
at least for now.
Yeah, especially funneling money over to Russia rather than having our own commercial entities launched from our own continental U.S.
So what do you think? Elon Musk, does he have – he's like, yeah, go ahead and file that suit because you should be able to make a spaceport wherever you want.
Among other things I would say. I'm also thinking along the lines of like the guy is basically Stark, the Iron Man character.
Yeah, Tony Stark.
Yeah, you should just
– just let him do whatever he
just
wants.
Just let him do it and he'll figure it out.
I don't know. He's already teaming up with the Russians. I'm not sure how on our side he is.
Well, except that he's publicly
– Oh my God, Bonnie.
I mean, if we're going to play superhero.
Yeah.
I yeah, we saw how that happened and how that worked out in Iron Man 2.
Anyway.
I didn't see it. No spoilers.
I forgot. There were
I'm sure everything was rosy.
There's a lot of rubble in that movie.
Yeah.
Or was that the third one?
That's every movie these days, though.
Rubble.
Rubble, rubble, rubble.
Rubble, rubble, rubble.
Enough with explosions.
All right. Well, good luck to Elon Musk getting everything that he wants like a spoiled child. Oh. All right.
What's... Wow. Come on.
Well, I don't know. I think
really good electric car pushing forward the electric infrastructure.
Well, that's fine. That's very nice. That doesn't mean he should be able to do whatever he wants.
That's true. But then again, compared to the other people who are doing everything that they want because they're rich, I'd prefer the person who was actually doing some good.
All right. Okay. Good for now. What's happening with Street View? How can you use Street View for time travel?
Yeah, this is also just a quick story, which is that Google Street View, which is the technology that lets you look at imagery that was taken by Google Street View cars that are driving down the street, mm-hmm. so you can see what your house looked like last time the Street View car drove by it. Well, these Street View cars are out driving constantly because, you know, cities change and they don't want to have old data and old imagery and everything. So as it turns out, Google is now allowing you, they added in their interface this thing which allows you to go back in time with Street View. So you can actually look at all of the historical Street View images. So, for example, in a busy metropolitan area or the middle of a city where they're building some skyscraper or something, you can actually watch the skyscraper get built.
Oh, that's cool.
Or get unbuilt if you go backwards in time.
If you go backwards in time. Oh, there goes the skyscraper.
So I love that idea. The privacy implications, I don't know. I don't see them being all that much worse than they already are about, you know, imagery being taken constantly and everything. Yeah. But it's interesting to be able to look back in time.
Well, when you were describing that earlier, I thought, oh gosh, that would be really good for researchers.
Yeah,
I mean, it's a good research tool.
Yeah, it's basically taking your snapshot of the world and all of the streets mm-hmm. on the world that have been indexed. And making it, giving it another dimension, right?
Yeah.
Of time. That's kind of great. With some granularity, of course, but I don't know. I love the idea. So if you go to Google Maps right now, you may not have that feature, but you should be getting it soon.
And what was it, just like another thing you can click on?
It's going to be a little button in the Street View interface, which it's like a little clock looking thing, and you can click on that and step back.
Right. Okay.
So, cool.
Cool. Keep an eye out for it. Oh, Miles, it's too bad about net neutrality being dead.
Yeah.
I mean, it's basically dead now, right?
Wait, what?
Yeah, the FCC moved to redefine net neutrality to basically say, yeah, so companies, we can set it up so that companies can charge more for some companies to get a better service. And if they decide to give worse service selectively to another company, that's okay too. So it's effectively saying, yes, it's not neutrality, but
they're describing it as you can opt in to pay for a boost, right? Not that you're going to deliberately drag someone down. That's how they're describing it, but we all know what it means essentially is mm-hmm. if you don't have the money, then
it's
you
the FCC
can't
is not doing
as
their
good
job
service.
Is what it means.
Right.
It means they don't understand the problem, they're not doing the job, and they're serving the customer.
Well,
the company's better than or the telcos better than individuals or companies.
I actually don't know that they don't understand the problem, because you also have things like, oh, the Comcast, for example, is the one that's been in conflict with Netflix and actually mm-hmm. with myself and many other people in the room and in the community.
Comcast!
The senior VP of governmental affairs, Meredith Baker, is also a former FCC commissioner.
Okay.
Like, this uh-huh. is the revolving door there is. So to say they don't understand the problem, I think, is disingenuous.
But who doesn't understand the problem? I'd be more impressed if someone from the high-end tech industry became part of the FCC, going the other way. Then I would think, like, okay, they know something.
But there are a couple of things. One, there's a new White House petition talking about net neutrality, people trying to get a response from the White House to see if they can get them to do anything.
Good.
The FCC being an appointed body by the executive branch, so that would have some pull. Now, there is something that Obama could do if he were sufficiently pushed to do so.
Why is net neutrality so important, Miles?
That is an area where entrenched interests, moneyed interests, would have the ability to put forth a message, and then people who are just startups or don't have an existing user base would have a hard time getting into that market. It ends up being trending toward oligopoly.
The broadcast
that
metaphor,
helped me so much, Miles. That was too much.
The broadcast metaphor might be in an era of Clear Channel, it's hard for an independent radio station, a community-level radio station, to have any space to do their thing. With net neutrality being gone, with being able to sort of pay your way into muscling up more of the band, then it's more difficult for smaller entities to have equal service.
We have this amazing perspective on the web that anybody can have a voice, right? All they do is make a website and or put up a video, whatever, and they have a voice that's is equal footing as everybody else's voice. Mm-hmm. And the lack of net neutrality, pulling a system in place where instead it's mandated and managed by these telcos on what voice can be heard, is really kind of a scary thing. Now, the problem, of course, is it's not that what the FCC is saying in this situation is that, well, we're not going to make sure the voices are heard, just not as well. Turn the volume down on some people. Depending on how much money you pay, you can have your volume up a bit. Yeah. And it's pretty
Which,
nasty.
In the case of streaming services, you end up with, well, if you degrade the service, it means that you end up with the video is, you know, you stop buffering.
Oh, or it's choppy, low quality.
It's so annoying.
Yeah. Or drops in quality, And so something as a technical aside, that people have been talking about, and rumors are that one particular streaming company is talking about, is peer-to-peer streaming. And using a technology similar to BitTorrent, the founder of BitTorrent actually approached Netflix and was saying, hey, why don't you do this instead? I don't know what Netflix's position on that. I don't think they have a public position on that. And
I understand
Netflix has already paid the money to
Comcast. How does peer-to-peer help? If you and I are on different, like if you're using some other cable company, I'm using Comcast, and you and I want it peer-to-peer, the two telcos still are involved in that. So
yes,
why
they are,
but Netflix isn't.
Right. The service becomes so decentralized that it becomes you degrade everyone or you degrade no one.
Oh, I see. So there'd be no way to detect what the packets are actually for.
Right. And if two people were on the same ISP or several people were on the same ISP, let's say you had, you know, five people on Comcast, five people on AT&T, the folks on Comcast could share with one another very quickly, potentially, without degrading the network service going on to the backbone.
You know what? I'll work on this next week. I'll just make this happen. It sounds like a very complicated problem. Exactly.
Oh, it is. It absolutely is. Right now, BitTorrent, you have no control over in a swarm whether or not you have pieces of the file from the back end coming for the front end. It all kind of comes in piecemeal altogether. But I know also that the company behind BitTorrent, or the person who invented the protocol, made a company. He has been working for quite some time on having prioritization for the front of the file. So you still have a swarm, and it doesn't perform quite as well, but you still have that ability to front load it so that you can do the streaming while you're still loading stuff in.
So seems kind to of me a better way to do it is to legislate an equal space on the internet. It seems to me like that's a clean way to do it.
Well, that's, of course, the problem is that legislation is slow. Bureaucracy is slow. Yeah. And, you know, I feel like it's like a bunch of flies buzzing around an elephant. Like, the elephant might be moving pretty slow, but then maybe the flies can be more agile. This is a horrible metaphor, but
it is. You take a lot of flies to change the direction of an elephant.
Yeah, but maybe. Honestly, I don't know. Well, I guess what I'm trying to say is technical solutions are easier, much easier and faster to implement than legislative or bureaucratic solutions.
So, but that would require the folks who are developing that tech to be to have the public good in mind.
Aha, indeed.
I still like the idea of peer-to-peer. Like, I would love it if iTunes had the ability to do a podcast that went over a BitTorrent download, because that would mean that GeekSpeak could put up a torrent file, and it didn't matter how many people liked GeekSpeak and started getting onto the podcast, everyone would get a fast download speed, and you know, the number of people, it would not scale linearly. Sure. It would be a logarithmic.
Well, that would play very well into our plans for world domination.
Yes, indeed.
Do we have time for another quick one? What's going on with WhatsApp?
Oh, I was thinking that we could maybe go into the ethical dilemmas, because we were talking about just that exactly just a moment ago. I'll do a quick one.
Okay.
Which is, I don't want to. So the story is 12 ethical dilemmas for programmers. I'm going to cover five really quickly. Basically, programmers a lot of times programmers, they're just code monkeys, right?
Let's just cover one.
One.
Because it's about time for a break.
All right. Number one is log files, what to save and how to handle them. So if you're a coder, how do you deal with that issue? It's a technical issue, but it's also beyond.
It's the metadata we're talking about the government always getting, right? So as a program, if you have an application.
But it's beyond that, though. Yeah. It's also things like cyberbullying. If you want to find out who someone was that came in, you have to have log files.
Right.
And if you don't keep them, then you have no memory.
Right. But if you do keep them, you have responsibility. And so the question of what you log and what you don't log is normally up to the programmer to choose. That's a really interesting ethical problem.
Well, there are actually quite a few laws regarding log retention.
Of course. Yeah.
So it's not just up to the programmer. There's a large legal department that will come knock on your door.
Very cool.
Yeah. So this is juicy and beefy, and I want us to have plenty of time to talk about it. So let's kick this forward to our third segment, because coming up after the break, we'll be talking to Matt Prater and his students about the battery experiment.
This is Geek Speak. I'm Lyle Troxell. And joining me via Skype, I hope. Hello, Matt. Are you with us?
Yes. Oh,
wonderful. Wonderful. Glad to hear from you. Via Skype. From Arizona, Gilbert, Arizona, is Matt Prater. He's a first-year chemistry teacher. He has a long history in actually radiochemist in the pharmaceutical industry for 13 years. And recently, about a year ago, started teaching high school. And I guess you were listening to Geek Speak, right, Matt?
Yes, I was listening to Geek Speak last August, and you were talking about the bouncing battery.
Yes. So we had this great story that Ben brought up, I think, that if you took an alkaline battery, that's a normal AA or AAA battery.
Oh, I think it was Brian, wasn't it?
Brian. Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
And you bounce it on a table, it'll bounce a certain way. And then if you take a same type of battery, but you drain it, you use it for a while in your flashlight and it's dead, and you bounce it again, the bounce would be different. We had a lot of debate about this because it doesn't make a lot of sense to me why it might be different. So we thought, well, it could be that the chemical composition of the battery changes, the mass shouldn't change, but if the crystalline structure changes, the properties of the wrapped bounds. You know, we did this kind of on the fly thing. So then, Matt, you text us or call us or contact us and say, you know what? That sounds like a perfect thing for my students. So let's introduce some of your students. We have in the room with you as well is Joey, and he's a second year high school student at Gilbert Public School System. And Joey's involved in the Highland Hawks robotics team, competing in the First Tech Challenge, which is a robotics challenge. And he would like to attend Arizona State University and attain an engineering degree and work for Intel, I guess. So is that true, Joey?
Yeah.
Well, that's very cool. You sound very techie. And then to some degree, Mandy is kind of in line with Ben and I's experience through college and stuff. Mandy is a junior in high school, and she's planning on attending university and focus with a major in teacher and a minor in theater arts. And Mandy's been on 20 performances or so. She's got a lot of stage work. So, Mandy, welcome to Geek Speak as well.
Thank you.
So what, Joey and Mandy, what did Matt actually assign to you as a class assignment for your science class?
Well, we started with listening to the show and what you guys talked about. And then we came up with our own ideas of how we could test and make up an experiment for this. So we split up into groups and we brainstormed some ideas for possible ideas for experiments. And then we just, we talked about them and we limited it to the best two experiments and we went with that.
Okay. So what were your experiments? Joey, can you explain to me the two experiments that you guys decided to go with as a class?
What we did was we ended up, getting the volume or the volume of the batteries. So we dropped the batteries in water to get their volume.
Mm-hmm.
And then we also weighed them to get the density.
Right.
Yeah. What they had done real quick, each group, we had divided into groups and I had each group do a brainstorming session to come up with as many ideas as they could. Then each group presented the two best ideas to the class.
Okay.
And we had them comment and ask questions about those ideas. Then I decided which idea we would go with, based on cost and safety and all the other things.
Okay. So it sounded like one of the tests was to figure out its density, which makes a lot of sense. And that's, of course, volume over mass. And so that determines how much material per cubic centimeter there actually is in the battery, how much mass there is. That's the density. Why was that? What was the thought you had about trying to test the battery's density? Why would that matter?
Well, we could, the thought process, you guys had kind of bounced around it and thought maybe density would work out.
Uh-huh.
And it seemed like a good thing to test. It seemed to work out really well. So I created a lab and we had the students do the density or actually record the density among many other things.
Okay.
In the lab, I'll have Mandy speak about what we actually did or what the lab was composed of.
Yeah, let's do that. So again, we're talking with high school students from the Gilbert Public School System. Matt Prater is the teacher. And so go on, tell us more.
So basically we were split into groups and each group got about 6 batteries and we all assigned them numbers, like lot numbers. And so the 2 things we did was we measured the bounce of it. So we measured it from 0 to 2 based on how much bounce we saw it gave off.
Okay.
And then after that, we saw the amount of energy it gave off. So we put them in flashlights and saw how powerful the light was coming out of the flashlight. And then we did the density like Joey talked about.
Okay. So we're talking about a lot of batteries bouncing, a lot of eyes on, a lot of numbers being recorded. So this is exactly the kind of thing you need to do in a science experiment, because one experience that we had in the air room just bouncing a battery, mm-hmm. we weren't really sure. And one of the things that I know from human experience is that we can't trust our instincts of seeing, right? That ability is actually not very good. We're good at tricking ourselves.
It counts as anecdotal evidence.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
So science experiments always require lots of tests and lots of trial runs, which is, of course, exactly what you did. All right, so you bounce a whole bunch of batteries. You see how much bounce they have. You see how much flashlight power they have from that perspective. And you figure out what their current density is by getting their volume and their weight and doing some simple math. So you've got all those numbers. Then how did you drain the batteries?
We didn't actually drain them. We had a mixture of fully charged and drained batteries.
Oh, cool.
We didn't actually perform the draining. We tested them in situ.
Okay, cool. So you had a whole bunch of these to test. So,
yep.
Okay. I don't want to, I feel like I want to spoil the surprise just by finding out the answer, but you sent me great data on like your entire class, including the way that you suggested they actually show their report. Instead of doing a printed form of report, you actually had them make a high-tech solution. To describe what you did, Matt, as the turning in the assignment.
All the students, we all were assigned to put all of our calculations into an Excel spreadsheet.
Okay.
And so after we did that, we uploaded those Excel spreadsheets to a website that each group created and designed.
So, oh, wow.
So each group actually has a public website that we can link to from the show that shows your results and your conclusions.
Exactly.
All right. Well, instead of making all of our audience do that, why don't you guys tell us, does the charge of a battery, of an alkaline battery, actually affect the quality of its bounce?
Okay, so during, like, for our results, we ended up testing about 134 batteries.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And we had 38 Energizer and 21 Duracell and then some lower end ones. Uh-huh.
Some other models,
yes. So you could test to see if brand had an effect,
okay,
too.
Cool.
Oh, that's interesting.
So we did notice a correlation between the bounce and the degree of discharge.
Huh.
Okay.
And another thing that we kind of thought about was that the correlation between density and the like quality of the battery had the higher quality it was, the more dense it was.
Okay. So the density of the battery does matter on how much charge. When you say quality, do you mean how bright it was, or do you mean how the quality of the battery or the expense of the battery?
Yeah. the expense.
Okay. So the amount of milliwatt hours, the higher the density, the better milliwatt hours the battery is going to produce, which is awesome.
Yeah. When you're buying the sunbeams or the Chinese specials, those tend to be a little lower density versus the Energizers or the Duracells.
Does for the Energizers and the Duracell, does the density change as you use the battery, as the charge goes away?
See, now that's the final answer, and I'll let Joey.
this is the big juicy one. Okay, what's this now?
Okay, so go ahead, Joey.
So we did not seem to see any correlation between the density and the bounce.
Okay, which I like, because the actual enclosed device, it shouldn't actually be losing anything. Electrons are flowing from one side to the other, and they've got no mass anyway, so it doesn't matter.
All right, where's it going to go?
Right, unless it's going to, you know, vent out something, which would not be good.
Yeah.
That's called a fail. So density doesn't change. So,
yep.
But you did see a correlation between battery bouncing and charge. Yes?
Yes.
Okay, wait a second. So why is it happening?
Well, this is where I come in. I kind of did some thinking about it, did a little research on it, and I have a little history with batteries, not a whole lot, but a little bit. And really, the big thing with the batteries and what makes these batteries, alkaline batteries, special is they're actually composed of two different gels.
Uh-huh.
There's a manganese or a paste or a gel. Mm-hmm. The outside is a manganese dioxide paste, and the inside is zinc dispersed in a potassium hydroxide paste. And the unique thing is that they have the zinc is always the limiting reagent. And we talked
right.
about limiting reagent in class, right, Joey mm-hmm. and Mandy?
Mm-hmm.
Yep. So we had talked about limiting reagents in the past, and the zinc is always set up to be the one we're going to run out of first.
And so when you say run out of, you got zinc in one gel, and as the electricity flows, the ions from zinc form and go across the barrier and go on to magnesium. And that's actually what's happening is a chemical movement, and that chemical movement results in excess of electrons. And that's kind of the flow of electrons. Is that kind of the general way it works? Okay.
Yep, that's exactly correct. So what happened is they always use an excess of the manganese dioxide, because if the manganese dioxide was your limiting reagent, then the next reaction to go would be forming hydrogen gas, which is not what we want to do with our battery.
So instead, you make sure you got lots of magnesium dioxide and you have less zinc. And as the zinc moves across and bounds to every free magnesium dioxide molecule or changes that molecule, then you no longer have a charge. And that's why you can actually, technically, you can reverse that charge by throwing electricity the opposite direction. Unfortunately, that battery is not designed to do that, and it probably won't do it very well. But in any case, and it might blow up, so we don't recharge those. But you could. You can do it. In any case, so what you're saying is that the zinc would move from one location to the other, not changing the overall density of the battery itself, because that's contained, but the density of the different gels.
Exactly. And what would happen is most likely when the KOH, the potassium hydroxide gel, when the zinc becomes discharged, it goes from solid zinc metal to zinc oxide or zinc ions, that changes the actual makeup of the gel.
And when it
changes the makeup, it no longer allows a place for the vibrations to go. But before it would be able to chew up the vibrations, or it would be able to suck up the vibrations.
Okay, so which one bounces higher, a charged or empty battery?
An empty battery bounces higher.
And even though empty is not really true, because the density is staying the same. So so the term, when we say a drained battery bounces higher. Is that what you're saying?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
And so what you're saying is that before you had – and keep in mind the alkaline batteries, the way they work, the reason they're round is you actually roll two pieces of foil with these gels, right? You're rolling them up in like a tube. Is that right?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
So you have actually multiple layers of this gel, different types of gel over and over again. You want that because you want lots of surface area so that the metal, the ionized particles can actually – or molecules can go across. So to the other side, to bound to the magnesium. So when that happens, it leaves the gel – one gel layer very different, which doesn't form the kind of hard quality of metal. Like when you bounce a nail, it bounces better than bouncing a sandwich because it's got that hard resilience to it. And the zinc layer, your theory, your hypothesis is that zinc layer prior to charging, discharging it is actually kind of firm like a nail. And as you change it, it becomes a soft, squishy thing.
Actually, it's precisely the opposite. When it's fully charged, it's kind of squishy and it can accept those vibrations and deaden it out.
Ah, okay, yeah. Gotcha. And as it bonds, it makes a metal hard case as it bonds to the other side. Ah, yeah, yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. I knew I was going to mess that up as I started talking.
That's okay. It took me a while to come up with it myself.
That's fantastic. Well, it's a good theory. Now, are you going to go on to your advanced class and find out if that's true?
I don't know. We might do that. What I'd like to do, and we can talk about this later, but I'd like to set up a chemistry class for hire where if there's any chemistry problems you come up with, we could as a class, not just this year, but next year and whenever, come up and try to solve your problems.
Yay. Oh, Matt, you are on our call list, man.
I want to do that.
We have a science class ready whenever we run into a problem we're not sure the answer of.
Ooh.
You just gave me a Christmas present. Thank you so much. It's fantastic. So,
glad to be here.
So, Joey and Mandy, was it neat to see the actual experience? I mean, what was it like to see this experience go through? Did your perceptions of what would happen versus what did happen, did they change?
Well, we listened to the podcast numerous times, so we already knew going into it what was going to happen.
Busted. Okay.
So, wait, are you saying that I predicted it? Or we predicted, I should say? The geeks predicted it?
He's saying more about the bouncing.
The
part.
Bouncing. Yeah. Not why. Not, but
so you knew the bounce was going to happen because we saw it.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. All right. So, So just to sum up, if you take a normal round battery, like a AA, a AAA, a C, or so on, and you bounce it when it's fully charged, it's not going to bounce very well. It's going to kind of go boop. When you bounce it when it's empty, it's going to kind of go brrr. I don't have a battery on me, but it's a great little sound, and it bounces more. And the reason for that is as the battery is being used up, the zinc from one side is bonding to the magnesium on the other side. These are the two different, the anodes and the cathodes of the battery. And as those molecules move over, it makes a hard shell of magnesium. What is it? Magnesium, zinc. What's the chemical reaction of that material? What is it called?
Well, you go from magnesium dioxide to dimagnesium trioxide. So you change the magnesium one way, and the zinc goes from zinc metal to a zinc ion.
Right. So the magnesium dioxide is the bouncy stuff that you generate as you use the battery.
Yep, exactly.
All right, so long and the short of it, if you have two batteries, you know one's good and one's bad, you can tell really easily. If you think you know how well a battery bounces, you can actually tell if it's charged or not just from your own experience. Fantastic.
Yep. So nice.
And we will call again upon your fantastic class to find out other answers of science when we run into problems here on Geek Speak. That is Joey and Mandy, they're high school students in the Gilbert Public School System of Gilbert, Arizona. And that is Matt Prater, a listener of Geek Speak, who forces students to listen to our program before letting them test one of our crazy stories.
And if you want to hear... Yeah, many times. And if you want to hear that original podcast about the batteries bouncing, that happened on August 17th of 2013, and you can find it at geekspeak.org.
Matt, Mandy, and Joey, thank you so much for listening to GeekSpeak, for being on the show, and for doing science. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll talk to you again soon, I'm sure.
Sounds good. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, that was great. Hey, let's go to a break and then come right back because there's lots more to talk about here on Geek Speak on 88.9 KUSP. And if you like Geek Speak, another program to check out at KUSP is the 7th Avenue Project. It happens Sundays at noon on KUSP. And tomorrow, over the last 4 years, the San Francisco-based singer-songwriter MacLeet has been dazzling critics with a sound that ranges from jazz to soul to folk and cabaret. She's been compared to Joni Mitchell, Joan Armatrading, and Nina Simone, but she has a style all her own, influenced by her Ethiopian heritage. She talks tomorrow with KUSP's Robert Polly about her life and approach to music while sharing tunes from her new album, We Are Alive. That's another great one, the 7th Avenue Project, Sunday at noon here on KUSP, or whenever you like at KUSP.org. Right now you're listening to Geek Speak on 88.9 KUSP. I'm Bonnie Primsch talking with Ben Jaffe, Miles Elam, and Lyle Troxell, and we have so much more to cover, including a warning. Maybe, Lyle, we should start with that. You know, during that whole thing, we talked about how could they guess what the insides of the battery were, and a person could reasonably think, well, why didn't they just open them up? And why shouldn't they?
And early on, he mentioned, the teacher mentioned that there was safety – of all the decisions that students decided to test, there might be safety implications. He just hinted that there might be – and there is. And the thing is, when we talk about those metals and those oxides moving between the two layers of the batteries, the reason why they can free flow is because there's an acid eating them away.
Yes.
So the entire thing is drenched in acid. You've heard of battery acid. That's how batteries work. You have to have a substrate of acid so that it allows these things to move and flow around. So when you open up a battery like that, mm-hmm. one of the things that comes out is acid. Not the best thing for high school unless you really have your masks on, your leather gloves. And so it's a more advanced problem to test into.
Or a relatively low pH acid at that.
That's right. It needs the lower the pH, the better it's going to be at doing what it does.
And the worse it is for your skin. For your skin.
Yeah. Exactly.
So no opening of the batteries.
Don't open the batteries. And that's why we recycle batteries. That's why we don't throw them away because of that. And the metals are in there as well. We'd rather reuse them.
Yeah. You know, I could use a geek bit. Who's got a geek bit for me, Miles?
Yes. It just so happens that I have an iPhone 5 whose power button on top doesn't work and hasn't worked for about a year or a little bit more now.
Okay. The button on the top.
Right.
Okay, the other button would be a problem.
Yes. The home button works fine, but if I ever want to turn the screen off, yeah, not so much. Huh. Or if I want to reboot the phone, not so much. I would have to wait for the battery to drain out before I could.
Is that how you do it? Is that how you reboot it?
If I were going to, yeah. Otherwise, I just wait for a software update, and then I just do that, and it reboots.
Well, that's no good. Your brand new iPhone 5. That's no fun.
Well, it's not a brand new one. I mean, it's
iPhone 5.
Yeah.
And that's kind of
a couple
new.
Years old. Well, it turns out that I'm not the only one who had this problem.
No.
I was just thinking, like, oh, I'll just, you know, grin and bear because I don't, you know, whatever. I can still use it. Turns out that a lot of iPhone 5s have a flaky power button.
Dun, dun, dun.
And so Apple has put up a button replacement program. Sorry, the iPhone 5 Sleep Wake Button Replacement Program. And we'll replace your button.
How is this a geek bit?
Well, I don't know.
It's not a visual.
But it's a public service announcement.
It's a quick one.
Okay, it's a PSA.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay.
It's a recall. Is there a recall?
Yeah. Well, they'll take the phone back and they'll repair it even if it's not under warranty.
Well, that's nice.
The only problem is it'll take like 4 to 6 weeks.
My God, really?
What are you supposed to do without a phone?
They will give out a loaner.
Okay, all right. All right.
Which means I have to delete all of my sensitive data off of my phone first, do a backup, and always do a backup first.
Are you going to buy a new phone?
No. Yeah. Oh, good, yay!
Miles holds it out, fixes it, awesome.
Oh, my gosh. All right, so a while ago we were hinting at this 12 ethical dilemmas for programmers.
Oh, yes.
And we tucked into one of them, but there's at least 11 more.
Yes.
That's good, Bonnie.
That's good, right? Well, here's what I figure. Knowing us as geeks, we're going to generate some more in the topic of conversation.
Right. Well, this is actually just a list that I found actually on infoworld.com, and I'll put the link up on geekspeak.org. And as the developer of a software project that has about 5,000 users, I do sometimes run into some of these ethical dilemmas, right? You think, okay, you make a product and that's the end of it, but no. So ethical dilemma number 5, to bug fix or not to bug fix. So your software has a bug and you have to decide, should I ignore it and not worry about fixing it? Maybe it'll be an obsolete bug in a while. Maybe it's not a security issue. Maybe this, maybe that. Mm. So where is that line? It's
Your battle?
Yeah, it's very much a fuzzy line. Like, should I fix this bug or is it not important enough to make me push off all this new feature I'm working on?
Or rather the huge corpus of bugs.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
Because every software project has one. Some bugs are really easy to see. We should switch this. There's a SQL injection attack, you know, something like
that's
that.
That's a bad one. Another one is you've got a whole bunch of users, right? I have maybe a couple thousand users or a few thousand users, and maybe some of them are international users that don't speak English as their first language. Should I internationalize my app? How do I deal with all of these different users who have different languages, who have different ways of maybe even using the tool itself?
Mm-hmm.
So how do you deal with the fact that the internet is, by its very nature, international?
Yeah, and that's a big one. Sorry.
No, please.
That's a huge one because part of internationalization is just, am I using a character set like Unicode?
That can handle other language characters.
That can handle all those characters. You have the set of, do I make it available for me to localize it, which is what you're really doing when you're switching from language to language. You have to put in that infrastructure ahead of time if you will do it, and right. then in the future you have to go through the step of translation.
And what you're saying is if yeah. you don't set yourself up earlier, it's a lot more work later.
Right. If right. you don't do that first step, the last step is basically impossible. If you mm-hmm. don't do the second step, the third step becomes real yeah. pain in the butt.
I suppose course, the other option would be making it open source so that if people wanted to adjust it for their country of origin, they could.
But that's the thing, though, is unless you put the effort in the front at the very beginning, mm-hmm. it's really hard to retrofit it no matter who's yeah. doing it, if it's open source in yep. the community or not.
But they could
not.
Build it back up from scratch. Like, this they is could, an app yeah. that does what Miles' app does, but it's for France.
I think one of the concerns that happens with open source software when you open source something is if you're bunting, if you're just going, well, I made the source available, do it yourself. If mm-hmm. you took 2 years to build something and then you never design for another language to take place, yeah. and then you say, well, anybody else can do it, effectively they just have to rewrite it and it's going to take 2 years again. So you're not really yeah. helping So it's better
it's
to design.
It's more like intellectual right. property sharing.
Yeah, exactly. Which is useful. I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. Right, showing people how it works is great.
Yeah.
It's like the foundation of a house. Sometimes there are situations where you need to do it right at the beginning.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Otherwise,
it's never
going to
be a two-story
well
house.
Yeah, exactly.
But sometimes you don't have enough money for a two-story house.
Right.
Sometimes you don't have the time to because it is a time commitment.
Yeah, it is.
Or sometimes
the encoding isn't, but the internationalization.
Yeah, or sometimes, like in my case, I started out building my little tool just for myself. So, of course, I mean, I'm not going to not speak English.
You only
speak
six languages, so why would you possibly do more than that?
I do not speak. I know three words in six languages.
Oh, okay.
So.
How do you say three words in six languages?
I don't know.
Trey?
Tres palabras.
Moving on. I can count to 10 in six languages. Woohoo!
Woo!
All right, I got two more
two
for
more.
You
Let's
guys.
Move on, yes.
Two more of these 12.
Okay.
Programmer ethical dilemmas.
Log files. This is one I covered earlier. Log files, what to save and how to handle them. So programmers, at least I know myself, I like storing data all the time. Mm-hmm. I never want to delete data because, gosh, what if later on I need it? I mean,
sounds
is there...
like my dad in his garage.
It's exactly that same thing.
But of course, when you have 2 terabytes and all of the files you're thinking about deleting are a couple kilobytes, I mean, why not keep them? There is no negative consequence of keeping those files, right? But your users, I mean, do you want to keep all of the information that you could possibly log? No, that's not respectful to your users. And that's also probably something your users don't expect you to do. So that's an ethical dilemma.
You know,
where's that line?
The first one of the revs, one of the many revs of geekspeak.org website that Miles and I have done for years, right? When I switched to Ruby on Rails, I didn't know what I was doing. I was logging some things. And after a couple years of it running and us doing lots of shows, I realized that one of the things I was logging was the password of all the users were logging.
Whoops.
Oh. So I had tens of thousands of entries of everybody's passwords. And as passwords work, of course, most of the time people use similar passwords on lots of things.
Mm-hmm.
So as soon as I saw it, I took a look at my logs and searched for my password, found the logs that actually had those. And then I'm like, okay, what I need to do is delete the logs, but only the passwords. How do I do? So I made a whole complicated script not to open the file, not to look at it, because I didn't want to accidentally see one of you guys' passwords, but instead to actually find the pattern necessary to null that out in anybody's password in all the files. I spent a little while on it and got it working and cleared it out, and then of course turned it off. That was kind of an ethical problem,
and
right?
Some people wouldn't have done that. Some people would have just opened up the log files and deleted them.
Right.
You know?
Or found the password that Miles uses, searches for it, replaces it. But of course, in doing that, I would have seen it.
Or you know, done some statistical analysis to figure out what are the most common passwords. You see that happen all the time whenever there's a password breach.
Yeah, but all of you use awesome passwords, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
I use one password 123456.
No one ever thought of that. Yeah, it's the same as my luggage.
I spell 6 out.
Right. So the last one, which is one that I
last ethical dilemma
don't know if I'll ever have to deal with, but
okay.
Whether and how to transform users into products. So that one's a lot more like, you know, but at the same time, if you put basic advertising into your application or into your product or whatever it is, maybe it's a free product and you want to subsidize the cost of hosting it. That, in a way, is transforming your users into products. You're selling your users' eye space to another company, right? So, I don't know. It's
I totally want to make a marketing company called
iSpace. That's so good.
Spelled EYE.
Yeah, let's say it, and then get sued by Apple.
Yeah, right.
Too close. And,
definitely.
Yeah. Oh, God.
Well, I spelled EYE, but it's not the same.
So, anyway, those are 4 of the 12 ethical dilemmas
right.
in this article, and that will all be up on geekspeak.org.
Up on the geekspeak.org.
For your perusal.
Okay, so have a friend. recently lost a cat.
Oh.
I know. Uh-huh. And they're trying to figure out how they could find their cat.
Ah.
Lyle, do you have any tips?
Well, I have a great story about this that I want to talk about Facebook. We normally talk about Facebook being scary and creepy and kind of horrible. And that's because there's some odd ramifications of taking your entire networking and making it social and trying to make rules around that when we don't even have a language really for the kind of relationships we actually have. So I don't really fault Facebook for what they do. I kind of think of it as an interesting social problem. So recently, about a month and a half ago, 2 months ago, I was invited by somebody to join my local community website page or Facebook page. Mm-hmm. And what it is I live in Ben Lomond, which is in the Santa Cruz Mountains, and somebody made Ben Lomond Neighbors. Okay, and all it is just somebody made a Facebook page and then added everybody that they knew that lived near them in the same town. Mm-hmm. And I actually found it really interesting. I don't know these people. I know what they're talking about. They're talking about road construction in the area. They're talking about potholes, talking about someone finding a lost cat in Glen Arbor, which is one of the roads in our community. Mm-hmm. Christy and Damon found a cat that showed up on their doorstep. They didn't want the cat. They posted on this site to try to find people. Finally, someone said, just go to the SPCA. They're great in Santa Cruz. And so they took it down to the SPCA. The cat had a chip in it, so SPCA was able to search that. The cat's name is Buzz, and Buzz was lost 4 months ago in San Jose.
Oh, my gosh.
Which is actually a long ways away.
That's a long way. How did they get to Ben Lomond?
Yeah.
That poor kitty.
So, of course, the family that lost the cat is totally overjoyed because they got their cat back, which is fantastic. I don't know how it traveled that far, but some theories is that maybe it got in a car. Maybe it just walked.
I was about to say, That's 4 months.
4 months is a long enough time to walk that long. Yeah, that's true. But
if you're lost and you don't have any particular place that you're going, then
traveling as a cat,
a little knapsack on its back, you know, it's like a free cat in the world.
The United States is not the friendliest place for cats to travel by road, though, or travel over land, because we have so many roads and roads.
But there's also those mountains are full of things that like to eat kitties.
Yeah, like foxes. Yeah.
Right, but why would
coyotes.
Why would a cat want to use the road as opposed to just going through the hills?
I don't think you can walk around without going over road. It's true that some are slow and calm, but you can't really get around. It's not like we go, let's make a pass here that has no roads. Kids could go across counties. So that's what I was thinking, just that tumultuous journey for that little kitty cat. But what I thought was great was that, not that this actually helped the cat get found, because, of course, the best place to take an animal is an animal shelter, you know, SPCA is the one in here, because they're not going to try to terminate the cat, they're going to try to find a home. And then, if, of course, somebody does put a chip in it to actually scan it, all the better. You can actually find out who it is, which is fantastic. But just to say that it's neat to see communities around location existing in Facebook, which is not about location really. Mm-hmm. And I like knowing what my neighbors are doing and stuff. So I think it's a kind of cool thing to check out. Just check out your local neighborhood. If you have a community, see if there's a Facebook page. If not, make one and invite people, and you'll have a little online community of
your neighbors.
And then
you'll have like a message board. That's kind of a nice
idea.
Yeah, it's
kind of cool.
With the help of technology, Homeward Bound, The Incredible Journey, actually happened.
That's right.
Absolutely.
Minus two dogs.
Minus
just
two
one
dogs.
Cat.
You don't know. That cat might have traveled with two dogs for a while. You have
sassy.
No idea.
It's true. Well, that was heartwarming. Let's get back to some grim things.
Oh, no.
That would be my cue.
Yeah, of course it is. Okay, so Amazon embodies the gender gap
in tech. Yeah, it's been a long-standing issue, gender in the tech industry.
Oh, yes.
The gender divide based on forums and gaming, but also in the corporate world. And Amazon in particular has been one that has been called out by The Guardian in this article.
For the work culture?
Where it actually talks about the roles that people have. Oh. For example, it talks about there are 120 most senior managers, and really they're when they talk about this whole total, they talk about, well, there's the CEO, Jeff Bezos, and the 12 people that are closest to him, the senior team, the S team, as they call it, and they're all men.
Okay.
And then if you look at the people who are in that are really close, that directly report to the CEO or to that senior team, you know, many of them are middle managers or vice presidents and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But 13 of them are secretaries, executive assistants, and they are all women. And
does that look different at Amazon than it does at other high tech companies?
Yes. It depends upon the company, but I don't know about. I'm looking across at Lyle here.
We're looking around the room. Netflix. What about Google?
Google is better than that.
Yeah, I would say that. No, I would say that Netflix feels better than that. I haven't taken a survey by any means, but still, I mean, the amount of programmers that are men are still drastically bad. I mean, it's the balance is not even clearly even. In the administrative echelon, I think that it's a little better than that. There, in the 10 top officers, I know there's a few women in that group for Netflix.
So out of 119 senior managers, 18 are female.
And
so,
they are largely executive assistants.
Well, no. Taking away the executive assistants and taking away the senior staff.
Okay.
The senior 13.
Okay.
So you're left with 119 out of this original 132 staff that's in
and
the
this
top
is at Amazon.
Tiers of Amazon.
Yeah. Okay.
It's 15%.
15%. That's exactly right.
So what about
isn't
that?
Isn't the population a 50% balance?
We're slightly more than
51.
51%, yeah. Right.
Is anything happening what?
Well, this is an article that just came out yesterday, so I don't know that there's much that Amazon could have done in a single day, especially when one of those days is a weekend.
Yes. So they've just been recently called out for being so man-heavy at the top.
Yes.
Well, I guess...
especially a company that you wouldn't think this industry needs to be male.
You know, I hate to be completely depressing on this, but Miles, this isn't news. I mean, in the sense that we know this problem exists.
Yeah.
Isn't...
Really,
I mean,
do we?
Well, don't... Well, okay.
Well, we do.
We do in this
I
room.
Guess the four of us know. Okay, good. Good point. It needs to be broadened, the awareness of this problem. It's a serious problem. So what we're talking about is executive staff levels in tech companies not necessarily being as balanced gender-based than you'd think.
I mean,
pretty drastically bad.
Yeah, think of bookstores that are still in business. Think of Barnes & Nobles. If you look at that team, would that divide be so noticeable?
Right.
It's a good question. Have a good think about it, listeners.
What a nice depressing thing to end the show with, huh?
Oh, my goodness. Well, yep, that's what happened. You've been listening to Geek Speak for April 26th, 2014. Geek Speak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence and is used with permission. And Geek Speak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0, so reuse our stuff any way you like. Just tell them the geeks say hi. This is Public Radio for the Central Coast, 88.9 KUSP Santa Cruz, live online at kusp.org. Find out more about this or any episode of Geek Speak, please.